Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Glory Glory Man United podcast. I'm your host, as always, Gael Quinn. And joining me on the show today is Chris Nugent. Great to have you back on, Chris. How's it going?
Great to be on, Kyle. Not too bad, mate. Doing pretty good. Yep, in the circumstances. Yep, looking forward to having a wee chat again about all the goings-ons. Yep, all good.
All good, apart from the result yesterday.
I was going to say that exactly.
Yeah, I think United's long-term future may be looking a bit rosier, but in the short term, I think there's still going to be a lot of pain. Unfortunately, United's winning run came to an end yesterday. In January and for most of February, United had won most of the games. They drew one and won the rest. They'd won four Premier League games in a row. It felt like more, to be honest. But it all came crashing down at home to Fulham yesterday. On Friday, when we found out that Højlund was going to be injured for 2-3 weeks, we knew that was going to spell trouble because we'd been relying on his goals recently. And we already knew that Martinez and Shaw were missing. So no left back without our best defender and our only striker at the club, really, missing. We thought that it's not going to be as easy at home to Fulham as we thought. But it was even worse than we imagined. United were absolutely terrible on the day. It's amazing how the drop-off is so huge when we miss a couple of key players. All of a sudden, the team looks very average. Just looking at some of the stats, United again conceded a heavy number of shots, 17 to Fulham. That's 100 shots now conceded by United's defence in the last five Premier League games. Now, we've been getting away with it because we've been scoring goals at the other end of the pitch. Let's be honest, the performances in January, February haven't been that great, but we've been doing enough to get the job done. We're scoring late goals, we're scoring against the run of play on the case of Luton. We got the job done in the early part of the game before the Luton onslaught happened. But we didn't have Højlund to get away with it this time. United were absolutely abysmal from start to finish. Some really, really poor individual performances. Once again, the crowd were exasperated by Marcus Rashford's lack of effort. Bruno Fernandes was shocking again. Once again, his decision-making was poor. There was a particular incident that was highlighted in social media where he took on a left-footed shot from outside the box rather than picking somebody out in the box with a through ball. And then when that shot failed, he proceeded to go down like he'd been shot after a Fulham defender just brushed past him, and it was just embarrassing. It's not what you expect from a Manchester United captain. So all round a really poor display, Chris. And if we take a look at the goals, the first goal came from a set piece. We've seen Rashford turn his back as the ball was fired into the net. Too often United caught napping set pieces. The winning goal is a counter-attack because United are throwing everybody forward. And like Maguire would have known before the game started that Adama Traore can outpace not just him, but most people. And he was never going to catch him. He should have just slid in and took him out and took the red card for the team there and, you know, and salvaged the draw. But he didn't. And then when Traore played it to Iwobi, when he turned and shot into the corner, Diallo had his back to the play. It was just pathetic from a defender. And then Onana was once again a hologram. He didn't even move. The ball just went past him into the corner. And, you know, in the old days when we used to De Gea at least making an attempt, you know, to get down and save that. But Onana was just a statue. It's pretty appalling afternoon, wasn't it, Chris?
Horrendous. Pretty abysmal, Kai, like you said. And such a shame, you know, with having a decent run leading up to it. But as you rightly said, we weren't exactly setting the world alight anyway, even in those games, you know. And it's such a disappointment that, again, as you highlighted, that we're only ever an injury or two away from being abysmal again. You know, we've absolutely zero strength and depth at the minute. You know, we've got a half-decent first 11 who, you know, on their day can maybe beat most teams probably in the league. But, you know, you take one piece out of that jigsaw and all of a sudden we're bang average and we can get beat by anybody in the league. And that was proven yesterday. It's pretty pathetic. But like, yeah, again, you know, highlighting the decision making of Maguire and maybe not take Traore out, although noticeably, you know, obviously there's a bit few more phases of play between that and the actual goal. So yeah, other people culpable, Dalot being one of the biggest culprits, as you mentioned there. And then yeah, Onana, an absolute statue, didn't even try to get down to save that, you know, just didn't have the reactions to get down. And De Gea would have had those reactions and probably still does have those reactions. But yeah, bad. But the disappointing thing about it, more than the performance and more than the result, is what you highlighted with Felix or Rashford, Kyle. I think it's the attitude of some players, and Fernandez included, and the fact that, you know, listening and, you know, thinking about the way things, you know, were in days when we were playing better, was that, you know, nobody taking responsibility to stand up and call those players out, you know, even the dressing room. And because you're seeing the same things week after week after week, and it's clear that these guys, nobody's reprimanding them, you know, nobody's kind of, you know, either the manager or the coaches or within their own dressing room, you know, are grabbing them, you know, and sort of saying, look, that's not acceptable, you know, you need to do better. You know, it's just it just seems to be go through the motions, and that's fine. And that's the worst thing, I think, really. And that's what's the most concerning. Because if you've got a bad attitude and it lies to fester, you're never gonna sort it out. So yeah, pretty damning stuff. But as you said at the top of the podcast, Kyle, you know, in the short term things don't look great. I think the best we can hope from this season is to somehow scrape a Champions League place, and I do mean somehow, because it's not looking great at the minute, but that would probably be success at this stage. And then just hope that the new regime under Radcliffe, etc., actually starts to create an environment where we actually start to perform better in the future. But it's not looking good right now, unfortunately. Sounds like it's going to be get worse before it gets better, I guess, is probably the same.
Yeah, Rashford obviously was not solely to blame for what happened yesterday, but he epitomizes the going through the motions. Yesterday, he is an example where he lost the ball, then he looks to the sky and the fans go ballistic at him because he's not tracking back. And this has been a common theme. To me, I think Rashford is surrounded by yes men. His friends and family tell him how brilliant he is. He doesn't seem to respond to criticism. Or the crowd have been, you know, airing their frustration all season with him. They've been cheering him off when he's been substituted. But he doesn't seem to get it. He doesn't change. We've seen one of his worst performances was against Newcastle, where him and Martial didn't try a leg, and United were basically playing with nine men. And this, nothing has changed, you know. And then I don't think, you know, when he went out in Belfast for those two nights and he missed training as a result, his only punishment was to miss an FA Cup game against Newport. And then he was straight back in 4 days later against Wolves. That's not a punishment, in my opinion. So even when he does wrong, he's not really been punished. And as I say, I think he's surrounded by yes men who tell him how great he is. And this is why he doesn't respond to criticism, doesn't think he's doing anything wrong. I think there's several players in the squad who think that it's everybody else's fault and not theirs. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's a culture at United now, isn't it?
It is. I feel like sometimes in the modern game in general, you know, it's a weird, and you kind of see it with Maguire, you know, until the penny seemed to drop. It's almost like, you know, in the social media era, players probably get so much criticism that they have to block it all out. But there's almost so much opinion and so much exposure to people's opinion that sometimes you think they actually don't know what to block out and what to not block out. You know, and yeah, there's always going to be trolls on social media that are going to be over the top that you should block out and not listen to. And journalists sometimes, you know, like to stoke the fire. But I do think that, you know, there should be people around him, like you say, Kyle, you know, and if not in his own family environment, at the very least, you know, it within the club and within the dressing room, that should be doing what they would have done back in the day and rallied around and went, look, you know, this is not good enough. Or, you know, look, if you're having a bad moment, we need to sort this out. You know, so yeah, it seems like whatever it is, the right influences aren't around him to get the best out of him, because, you know, he's a player who's had massive potential, and so far he's looking like one of those players who has massive potential and just that never actually really fulfills it. Certainly not for Manchester United anyway, and that's really, really disappointing. And yeah, he epitomizes the problems in the dressing room and the seeming, you know, seemingly kind of poor culture around the club. in general. You know, I'm talking about Maguire as an example, because Maguire was in a similar position for a while, and you know, took it out on everybody, and you know, and didn't look to himself, and then eventually the penny dropped that, well, actually the only way to get out of this is for me to get the head down, perform better, and then people get off my back. Rashford doesn't seem to have done that, and that's the problem. You know, he's not gone down that road of you know, taking on board the good influences and the right thing, and then blocking out the noise. You know, it seems like he's blocking out everything, and he's just thinking about himself, you know, and not even his own teammates, like you say. Times he's just squared all, and he doesn't, and that's bad. So almost gone too into himself. So yeah, it epitomizes wider issues, I think, at the club in general. It's not a great environment, it seems.
Well, I've got to say that under the new part ownership, in my opinion, only four players should be safe, and that does not include Rashford or Bruno Fernandes, given how they performed this season. In my opinion, the only players that should be safe are Lisandro Martinez, Kobbie Mainoo, Alejandro Garnacho, and Rasmus Højlund. In my opinion, everybody else is sellable. What do you think, Chris?
I think that's fair, Kyle. I can't think of too many more that wouldn't be sellable. You know, maybe Luke Shaw, who does perform well.
Well, the reason why I didn't put him in that category is because he's so injury prone. He's missed so many games through injury.
I know. I agree. I agree with you. I think that's fair. Like, and you know, that's the same with Varane, and in some ways, actually Martinez too. But you hope that's just bad luck for him, that maybe that'll change. But no, it's hard to argue, Kai. There's just not too many around the club for the last few years that you would really say they are absolutely indispensable. There's very, very few. Yeah, the four that you named are probably the only ones, really. Yeah, I think that, I mean, I guess what I hope is that, for obvious reasons, you can't sell an entire squad. So, you know, most of those guys will remain. There's a few who will more obviously go. Probably some of the worst offenders who should go, like Martial, who's out of contract and will definitely go. But you're right. Yeah.
I think... And he also will target the high earners as well, who are not doing it. That's the sense that I'm getting.
Yeah, 100%.
And one of those is Casemiro. And I seen him yesterday lose the ball in the centre of the park again, and then didn't have the pace to get back. It resulted in an Andres Pereira curler, which Onana actually saved, you know, for Bladium. And then there was another incident, another chance for Fulham. It was the Fulham striker who turned Lindelof so easily in the box, and then his shot hit the post. Lindelof, another... I mean, I could have predicted before the game that if you select Lindelof for left back, you're asking for trouble. And I'm aware there's not many options. We don't actually have an orthodox left back available at the moment. But we've seen Lindelof against Luton and Aston Villa, and it was a disaster. And Ten Hag didn't learn from that. Even if he had to put Amrabat in there, it's not a great option, but you have to try something different other than Lindelof, because we know what we're going to get from him now. He did limp off at the very end of the game, so it's probably a good thing that he's probably not going to be available for the Forest game. So it'll be interesting to see who he selects at left back there. But it's massive. It's a massive headache for United and Ten Hag that there's no orthodox left back and there's no centre forward, because once again Rashford played through the middle, and you know, he's even lazier when he plays up front, because you can see from his body language he doesn't want to play up front. And I, you know, a lot of people were arguing that he should have just kept Garnacho and the other winger. Rashford, obviously, Garnacho and Rashford in their favourite positions, and just played McTominay up front just to disrupt the team as little as possible. But to bring Rashford in as centre forward, he had to move Garnacho to the left, and then he played Amari Fozan on the right in his first start for Manchester United. None of that worked. It caused massive disruption to the team. And United, Garnacho was probably our biggest threat on the day. He was trying to make things happen. But yeah, it's really, really, it really is going to be a struggle. for the next few weeks without a striker and without a left back. But also we have to look at the setup as well. I don't know what the plan is, what the style of play is. I don't see any cohesion. I see a team of individuals. Even when we're winning games, we're relying on moments of individual brilliance from Højlund, Garnacho, Menu to win games. There's no pattern to Man United's play. And that's pretty damning on the coach. Look how, as I said earlier, look how many shots that are raining down on our goal. 100 shots in 5 games. And how easy it is to get through United's midfield. And the defence are constantly under pressure. And yeah, Ten Hag, I'm afraid, doesn't get a free pass either. Because here's another reason. Now, I do have some sympathy because of the injuries to key players, and any team would suffer as a result of that. But look at Liverpool today, who won the Carabao Cup final. They won without Alisson, Alexander-Arnold, Nunez, Salah, Jota, and Jones, and yet they still were able to beat Chelsea in a League Cup final. So every team is going to experience injuries. Like Manchester City have been missed Haaland at points this season. They missed De Bruyne for a long period. They missed Rodri for 3 games in a row. And they're still in and around the top of the table. So you can't really use injuries as an excuse, can you?
No, absolutely not. In fact, I think what it does, Kyle, is it highlights the problem at Man United that's been there for a long time, and that I really hope that is now going to be sorted out by Radcliffe and Brailsford and Barada and Ashworth if he comes in, is that a club not thinking in football terms, not planning for, you know, scenarios that happen over the course of a football season where you have guys injured and you need to have good backup. And that's the problem, is the fact that we're in this position with the amount of money that we've spent, which fans of other clubs and journalists always like to throw in the face of Manchester United. And it's hard to argue, really. You know, misspent hundreds and hundreds of millions. The fact that we're now in a position after spending all that money that we don't have good cover in key positions. And I think that's the highlight. And that is poor resource management, poor recruitment, and all of the rest. So I think that highlights the environment that's been operating at Man United for a long time, that scenario would happen and that we can't cope, like you say, and showing how well-run football clubs like Manchester City and Liverpool have faced similar problems but have actually preempted them and are able to actually cope with them. So I think that's one issue, which the how we perform or don't perform with injuries to key players highlights that problem. The second thing, actually, just when you're saying about Ten Hag and not seeing a style of play, I was listening to the Overlap podcast last week, and Jaap Stam was on. I don't know when this was from. I think it was a slightly old one, maybe from even before Christmas. But he said, interestingly, which caught my ear, that either he'd spoke to Ten Hag or he'd heard from somebody around Ten Hag that Ten Hag had said that the style that he likes to play, he won't be able to play at Manchester United. Now, I don't know where he heard that from or what the source of that was, but that was really interesting to me, because I remember before Ten Hag came in, seeing interviews with him at Ajax, and he basically said that he has a very distinct style of play that he likes to implement, but he's pragmatic enough to understand that when he comes to a club in the early, you know, in the early months or the first season, that he's pragmatic enough to just play with what he has while building towards a style. But that's interesting. If he said that, and if that's true, that he actually has almost given up on implementing a style and saying, with the current environment, with the players I have, that style isn't going to happen. Now, I'm not saying that he takes no blame for that, but that's interesting if he said that he doesn't even have the confidence or the kind of feeling that his style will ever be implemented. And that's, I think that's pretty bad if that's the truth. So that would explain why it's constant chopping and changing. There is no style, because he must still be operating in, if that's true, this pragmatic mode where it's just have to make the best of what I've got. And that's a damning indictment of the whole football culture at the club, if that's true. So yeah, pretty bad.
It's chaotic. I'm relying on moments to win games. Much exactly. Like the Ollie era, really. Nothing really has changed. I mean, Carrie Skates here says that we look like an under 12 team at times, and that we're going to end up in the Europa Conference League, if we're lucky. Now, just as you mentioned, Jaap Stam there, Dutchman, of course, critiquing Ten Hag. I also seen comments from a primary...
If we're lucky, yeah.
I seen a comment from a Ajax fan last night on social media. You know, he's a big... He called the European lad, and he has nearly a million followers on Twitter. So, you know, he's quite well known on social media, this Ajax fan. And he was asked for his thoughts, you know, on what he thinks about Ten Hag at Manchester United. And here's what he said. So far, I would rate his time at Manchester United as very much a failure. You are Manchester United. You shouldn't be able to get dominated week in, week out by no matter who you play, which is happening. Even in those small periods where you get results, the performances remain very bad. So no, I don't think Ten Hag is capable. This job is too big for him. That's a pretty damning assessment of an Ajax fan who's enjoyed a lot of success with Ten Hag, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a very damning assessment, absolutely. Yeah, that's extremely damning. Yeah. And that's the thing, you know, too, is that, you know, Ajax are the biggest club in Holland, but, you know, they're not on the level of Manchester United in terms of the scrutiny you're under and what's expected and stuff. And that's the thing, we say that all the time, Kyle, about players coming to Manchester United and not being able to cope with the pressure and cope with the scrutiny and cope with the size of things. And maybe that applies to managers as well. You know, we always got that feeling with David Moyes that he felt like he was in, you know, had imposter syndrome. He felt like he was, you know, lucky to be there and didn't feel that his shoes were big enough. We obviously didn't have that problem with Van Gaal and with Mourinho, quite the opposite. But yeah, you know, maybe that is it. Maybe it is just too big a job for Ten Hag. I thought it was interesting in Radcliffe's interviews the other day, in one of the interviews, that he talked about getting the most out of the playing squad and getting the most out of the coach. And that was an interesting frame of words for me. Saying that, in other words, that he, you know, and not saying supporting the coach, saying getting the most out of the coach, as if to say the coach isn't actually performing at the level required either. So that was interesting, I thought. So while I feel like he may get the backing in the short term, in the sense of I don't think that the Ineos guys are people who will jump in decisions again. I think the frame of words that Radcliffe used was he would rather walk to the right decision rather than run to the wrong decision. So I don't feel he'll make any knee-jerk reactions on Ten Hag, but I think he's definitely under scrutiny for obvious reasons. I think we can all see that. So yeah, right now it's not looking good for him.
Well, Radcliffe did say that he would delegate decisions on the manager and players to Omar Berada and Dan Ashworth whenever they come in, but they're not in post yet. So for managerial change to happen mid-season, Brailsford and Radcliffe would have to do that themselves. And according to Radcliffe, no, they're not going to do that. They're going to delegate those decisions. But Radcliffe did highlight in his midweek interviews that he'd done with MUTV, the BBC and the written media, that the importance of being in the Champions League next season, that was an important goal for United. You know, that will help them in the transfer market to have that extra 60 million or whatever it is. So if it becomes obvious that United are not going to get into the Champions League next season, could they be tempted to make a change in terms of the manager? I don't know. I certainly don't at this point see Ten Hag lasting beyond the season. Champions League looks extremely unlikely. Winning the FA Cup is going to be tough. So, yeah, if Ten Hag, or if Radcliffe, sorry, is already saying right now the importance of being in the Champions League next season, and United don't achieve that, there's absolutely no way Ten Hag is going to be there next season, is he?
Not a chance. I think if he doesn't get a Champions League spot for next season, I think he's almost axed on as soon as that's apparent. I really feel like that's it. You know, I think that the decision is made. If it becomes obvious it's not going to happen, I think that the decision is made. In terms of whether they'll make a change to try and actually, you know, before the hand, to try and hope that they make it happen, that's an interesting question. The one thing they would make you think just maybe that could happen is the fact that while we're saying that, you know, that they're not going to jump into decisions and the guys aren't in place just yet, you know immediately that they're planning. They have been planning. They have been thinking. Him and Brailsford have been talking and thinking and planning, you know, before they took over Man United. You know, they've had a long time during the whole process of the bid going through. So there's no doubt in hell that, you know, about it, those guys will not have already been getting their ducks in a row and organizing themselves. So I would be shocked if they haven't already, you know, thought about potential candidates and thought about the scenario where Ten Hag has to go and who might replace him. So it may be that they do make that change for those reasons. And like you say, Kyle, you know, given that Radcliffe himself highlighted the importance of Champions League football, maybe, just maybe, they would make that reaction. Yeah, I mean, my head tells me that right now they'll give him Ten Hag at the end of the season. But yeah, you know, that's going to have to be a fine balance between not jumping into something and not getting themselves in a position where there's no Champions League football and they lose that money, which impacts FFP. I think that's actually the frame of words that Radcliffe said as well, was imagine the importance of it for FFP reasons. So yeah, it's going to be a difficult one. I think for Ten Hag right now, you know, he is bound to be feeling a little bit of pressure, and he's bound to know that his days are looking numbered unless things change. So yeah, things need to improve for sure for him.
Yeah, and it's going to be difficult for him to pick up results without key players. He relies on those players to get results, like we've saw in January, February, and whenever you take them out of the team, then United just go back to mediocrity again. So, and look at the next league fixture. It's probably the most difficult fixture of any season, away to Manchester City, who just enjoy whipping us every time we play them at their stadium, or sometimes at Old Trafford as well. And without an orthodox left back, without a centre forward, a midfield that's so easy to play through, you could see City's going 4 or 5 in that game, and that's not going to help Ten Hag either. No. That's a certainty we're going to lose that game, I think, even though they're not playing particularly well, but they'll still be good enough to beat us. The question is, can we get past Nottingham Forest in the FA Cup on Wednesday night? That's a big if. Obviously, we lost there in the league in I think it was, we discussed that game. No, it wasn't. No, me and you discussed the Villa game after Boxing Day, but the game after that was Nottingham Forest. And interestingly enough, that was the last time we lost, and Hoyland also missed that game as well. Yeah. So again, there's a pattern there where when Hoyland's missing through illness or injury, then we lose games. Forest are not a great side. I think they were battered yesterday by Aston Villa, and they weren't great whenever they beat us, to be honest. I just thought the reason why we lost that game is because Ten Hag decided to bring on McTominay for Menu at half time. It was totally baffled everyone, and McTominay failed to pick up the runs for both goals. So United not in a great position with the players they have available for Wednesday night. I'm hoping we can scrape through, but I'm a bit doubtful about that now. I don't even know. I have no idea who's going to play a left back. That forward line that played yesterday surely can't continue. He's going to have to try something new. But we talked about the lack of strength and depth there, both of us, already on this podcast. But Ten Hag hasn't helped himself with that either, because look at yesterday. Some of his former players that he's brought to Old Trafford. Anthony, he came on after 99 minutes. He started Amari Forzan ahead of him. He brought on Ahmad before him. That's how little faith he has in him now. Sofyan Amrabat, he didn't bring him on at all. And even when he does come on, he comes on when United are leading with about 5 minutes to go, just to see out the game. So the strength and depth, or lack thereof, hasn't been helped by Ten Hag's signings, that he's lost faith in them now. But obviously we have to take into account that he shouldn't have been making the signings in the first place. The total lack of structure up until now hasn't helped that situation. But all in all, it just looks like the writing's on the wall, really, to be honest. I do have certain sympathies for him with the injuries and all that, but you take everything into account, he has made a lot of mistakes, and it's a results business, and I just don't think he's going to last beyond May this year. Nope. I think he's 1 year left on his contract, and I think that'll be paid up and he'll be gone.
No, I think you're right. I think if you're in Radcliffe's in the team's shoes, I think really the thing that you're trying to decide on is how much of the current situation is down to the environment and how much is down to the manager. And you're kind of asking yourself, we know the environment's bad, but could this manager perform to the elite level that they're pushing for in an elite environment? And that's the question. The answer to that is not clear, simply because Man United hasn't been an elite environment for so long that it's hard to know, because there's no evidence to say that he could, because he hasn't done it, because Man United has been so disorganized. But they will definitely be asking themselves that question, I think, and they will be looking at what he's done up to now, and they'll be looking at scrutinizing the things that he has done, the decisions he has made, and thinking, are these the best decisions that a top manager would make in this scenario, or are they actually poor decisions within themselves as well? And certainly there's a number of those that will stick out that will be poor decisions. And I think that's what will be what Ten Hag will be judged on. It'll be judged on whether he could operate in the elite environment that Ineos are going to provide for the future. And if they think that, no, even in that environment, he's not the man, then I think that that's curtains for him. So, yeah, I think he himself is going to really have to show that he is not the problem, and that he, you know, in the right circumstances, would be the man to take it forward. And right now, it doesn't look that way. So, yeah, I think it's tough for him.
So Danny here says he still backs Ten Hag. The mess he's had to deal with in terms of injuries and also off the pitch matters in his first two seasons is incredibly unfair. Having said that, he's not immune to criticism. He says too many key injuries stifling our progress, and Luke Shaw needs replaced now. I would agree with that, because, you know, the best ability is availability, and Luke Shaw has missed the majority of this season. And Gary here says that only Dallow should survive of yesterday's backline. So none of them then, in my opinion. because Dallow's defending is shambolic. Now, it could have been a totally different day for Dallow had he'd another one of those shots from outside the box, and it hit the post. On a different day, that could have went in, and we could have been looking at him differently. But it wouldn't have changed anything in terms of his defending. You know, people might say I'm old school, but as a defender, your first job is to be to defend, and he is so incredibly bad at that. He's too far off his man. He's out of position. Like yesterday, turning his back when somebody's shooting, just falling asleep, ball watching. He's just not good enough as a defender. And what he brings going forward doesn't make up for that. You know, he's not Alexander Arnold, is he? Let's be honest. So I think we need to look, in my opinion, we need to look at replacing him as well. I know he has his fans out there.
But... No, I agree. I've defended him a lot. You know, there is things about him that I like. I know it's controversial. I actually do still prefer him to Wan-Bissaka, which is why I said on this podcast before I would probably get rid of them both, to be honest, because I think neither of them are have the package. But talking about that thing about turning his back, that's unforgivable. And that is the sort of thing that you can imagine being in a dressing room with Roy Keane and doing that. You'd only do it once, and that would be it. You'd never do it again. But unfortunately, that's, again, a symptomatic of the poor culture in the dressing room at United, and that stuff like that's allowed to continue. That's at that level at Man United, that should not be happening. You should, as Keane, you know, famously used to say about putting his body on the line, you know, you'd have stuck your face where it shouldn't be to stop something, just to stop a ball getting through. Turning your back is not what you should be doing. It's pretty bad. Definitely not good.
I laughed at this comment from one of my followers on Twitter yesterday when the team news dropped. She's called Michelle, and she says, Lindelof a left back, the worst thing ever, ever.
Yeah, fair enough. I can relate to the sentiment. I think we all can.
Yeah, and he's played left back in each of the last three games, and he has been abysmal. But, you know, he's not really great in his own position. So it's kind of unfair to ask him to play in another position. You know, he's just on hiding to nothing. And Ten Hag, he's probably going to be an enforced change now because of Lindelof's injury, but he really should have been looking to somebody else yesterday. Even if it was the young 16-year-old Harry Amass, who got from Watford quite recently, just throw him in, because the most important thing to me is having a left-footed left-back who is an orthodox left-back. Once you're playing people out of position, then the team is massively disrupted. I mean, Lindelof doesn't cross the halfway line either, so you get nothing down that side in terms of support for Garnacho, as it was yesterday. So it makes us predictable, as I always say. So I know playing a 16-year-old is not ideal in the Premier League, but I prefer to have left-footed players at left-back. And you know, nobody's going to expect big things from the young lad, so just give him a chance. He couldn't be any worse.
Totally agree. He'd be tenacious, if nothing else, you would imagine. Do you know what I mean? He'd give us all.
Yeah, like Brandon Williams, not the greatest footballer in the world, but boy, he'll give us all for the shirt.
Exactly, 100%.
So it's difficult. I think one of the things that's helping Ten Hag is the lack of world-class managers around at the moment that are available to United. Obviously, the two best managers in the world, arguably, are at our biggest rivals in Manchester City and Liverpool. Well, for the moment, in terms of Liverpool, Klopp's going to be leaving, but he's never going to come to United anyway. So there's been lots of names that have been touted as to... It seems inevitable now, really. I know people are still hanging on to the possibility of Ten Hag staying another season, but I see that's very unlikely unless we get into the Champions League, which itself looks unlikely now. So different names have been touted. Graham Potter, I just cannot entertain that. I know circumstances at Chelsea weren't brilliant for him. It's a basket case of a club, and you know, he not many people will succeed under Todd Bowley at Chelsea, at least in the immediate term. But I just think the job is too big for him as well. People talk about Julian Nagelsmann, the former Bayern Munich and Leipzig manager, and who's currently the coach of Germany up until the end of the Euros. It's been an interesting shout. Somebody said, who's not a fan of Nagelsmann, a United fan, said, but Solskjaer United beat his Red Bull Leipzig 5-0. When are people going to give Ole some credit? But the caveat to that is that, yes, United beat Leipzig 5-0 at Old Trafford, but there's two things we have to take into account. When we play them away from home, Leipzig won and put us out of the Champions League group stages. So they went through and we didn't. And secondly, Red Bull Leipzig had an inferior team to Manchester United and still went through instead of United. So if you look at the 5-0 in isolation, it looks great from Ollie's point of view and poor from Nagelsmann, but they're the ones who went through and we didn't, and they beat us in the away game. But Nagelsmann, he's been a coach since he was 28 years old. He's probably still not even 38 at this point. It'd be interesting to shout. He lost his job at Bayern Munich when they were still in all three competitions. I think it was, as Bruce explained to me, that there was a leak in the dressing room. Somebody was leaking stories to the media, and Nagelsmann accused one of the players, I think. But it turned out to be Nagelsmann's wife who was leaking stories to the press.
Didn't know that.
So it ended up him getting the sack and Thomas Tuchel coming in. So it wasn't really footballing reasons that led to that. And Tuchel obviously didn't bring the success that he was brought in to do. And he's now going to be leaving the club at the end of the season. They don't look likely to win the Bundesliga this season. They were still in with a shout of winning the treble when Nagelsmann was there. And I think Tuchel ended up winning the league in the last day of the season, but they definitely didn't win the treble, obviously. So Graham Potter's been talked about, Nagelsmann's been talked about. Obviously, they're talking about the Sporting Lisbon manager, who's won the league there so many times in a row. But again, that would be a bit of a Ten Hag signing, dominating a minor league and then coming to Old Trafford. You know, it's a totally different ballgame. And other managers have been touted, obviously Zidane, but that seems like a pipe dream. There's some, when you look at the list that the bookies have come up with, there's some really average names in there who do not excite most of the fans. So basically, Ten Hag is also being helped by the lack of options. So whoever they decide upon, they need to do their due diligence and make sure that he's the right guy. But, you know, it could take two or three managers before any of us, you know, stumble across the right man.
definitely agree. I definitely agree with Kyle. The one thing that in some of the rhetoric that's been coming out from many of us that I find is interesting, and I think it might be a hint at who the next manager will be, is again their talk about everything being at the elite level, you know, best in class, and 10 out of 10, you know, is the sort of language they're using. He's a 10 out of 10 and this. Or so I think that it's, you know, if they do pick somebody, I think it's going to be somebody that, like you say, I think they're going to do their due diligence on whoever it's going to be. And I don't think it's going to be a risk. I don't think it's, you know, if it's an up-and-coming manager, it'll be an up-and-coming manager with a great record who really looks to be on the upward trajectory. I don't think Graham Potter fits that bill for me. He was given a chance at Chelsea. I know it's a difficult place to go and things did not go well. I mean, I can't imagine, unless, you know, any of us see something that nobody else is seeing, that he's going to be the man for that job. I can't see it based on that alone. I mean, that brings you to who it might be. I don't know who that is. You know, I guess looking at some of the names that are floated about, maybe Thomas Tuchel, maybe, just because he's been at big clubs and he's got a good record. But then again, you know, his record has a few blemishes on it too. But, you know, if I thinking with their head on, I think they're going to look for somebody who's either just about to be knocking the door off the top level, or has already been managing it at the top level, and has, you know, moved on for maybe certain circumstances, and they think, we create an environment, this guy is elite level, if we create the right environment, he'll do it for us. I don't think they're going to take a risk on somebody who's, you know, maybe, you know, half mediocre. Yeah, so be interesting.
I think the problem is with Tuchel is he's a very pragmatic coach. I don't think his style of play would suit, you know, Manchester United. A bit like Mourinho just wasn't a great fit. I think I'm not saying Tuchel and Mourinho's football is exactly the same, but they just don't really play the United way. It was just obviously all out attacking football. Mm. I know I have a Chelsea fan who appears in this show, and he wasn't a fan of Tuchel's football either. Mm. So I don't think he's a natural fit, really. And another name that's been talked about is Alonso Bayer Leverkusen. Looks like a wonderful upcoming coach, but obviously has those links to Liverpool. Bayern Munich will probably want him in the summer if they can get him. And, you know, Real Madrid will obviously have their eyes on him too, given that he has a history of them too. So it just doesn't seem likely that he's going to rock up at Old Trafford, given his links to Liverpool and how in demand he's going to be from all the top clubs. Another name has been mentioned by some people as Hansi Flick. I know he won the treble with Bayern Munich, which is an amazing achievement. But his most recent job was with the Germany national team, and that didn't go very well, and he was sacked and replaced by Nagelsmann. So you talked about the upward trajectory there. When your most recent job is being sacked by a national team, you know, that's not great. But yeah, Winning the treble at Bayern is not to be sniffed at, obviously. So there's no obvious.
Like to remind everybody, including yourself, Kyle, that Pep Guardiola didn't manage to do that. So you're right.
No, he didn't. Hinkie has won the treble before Guardiola, and Hansi Flick won the treble after Guardiola at Bayern Munich, but Guardiola did not do that himself. In fact, I think Guardiola's Bayern lost 3 semi-finals in a row, and I think they were to Madrid and Barcelona, and they were battered in those semi-finals. So, and Guardiola, as you know, he's took a number of years to win the Champions League with Manchester City, and he won 1-0 against Inter last year. Obviously lost in the final to Thomas Tuchel when he was at Chelsea. It took a long time for Guardiola to win the Champions League without Messi. He's obviously done that, but the caveat to that is the 115 Premier League charges that Manchester City have been labelled with. I don't think we're going to get a conclusion to that process until the end of next season. Obviously, UEFA have tried to charge City, and, you know, it went through the arbitrary process, and City were found guilty of some charges but cleared of the main ones and weren't heavily punished. So moving on to Jim Ratcliffe then. As I said earlier in the show, in midweek, he spoke to Dan Rowan of the BBC, to Helen Evans of MUTV, who of course is the wife of Johnny, and he also did interviews with the written media, and so many interesting quotes there. I was listening to Samuel Lockhart's podcast in midweek there, and he obviously interviewed him as well, down in Mayfair, and he said this was brilliant. This is one of the best interviews he's ever done. It was so good that he kept every time he got a brilliant quote, he'd go, "Brilliant, that's going to be the headline," and then he had to scribble out and go, "No, this one's even better." And another one, "No, I'll have to bend that. This one's even better." He just couldn't believe the amount of brilliant quotes that he was giving him. It was just off the charts.
I love it.
One of the funniest bits of the interview is when he said that he joked about his rival for buying the club, Sheikh Jazim of Qatar. He joked that he doesn't know if he exists or not. That certainly got a few laughs. He says that he's never heard of him and the Glazers never met the guy, so he doesn't know if he exists. There was so much interesting stuff there. Some of it which we've touched on already, the importance of us qualifying for the Champions League. He talked about delegating decisions to the chief executive and the new director of football and the recruitment team. There's going to be a committee of three people who are going to make big decisions on managers and players. It's come out this morning that Radcliffe has said to get tough with United's highest earners, like I've said already, introducing a bonus-led pay structure that will only see players cash in if they are successful. So, they want to have a general cap of $300,000 a week. They may make an exception to that, if they sign a superstar. But the general rule that they want to have is nobody earns more than $300,000 a week, as a basic salary. And players will be given, motivation with bonuses that if they reach a certain amount of goals or the team win titles, then they will win bonuses. And that's the way it should be. It was like that in the past. We often hear Roy Keane talking about the bonus incentives that were around when he was playing. You have goal bonuses, trophy bonuses, clean sheet bonuses, and that's the way it should be. Because that gives you actual motivation to perform. What's been labelled at United in the last 11 years is they get their money far too easily and they're paid far too much. Average players getting far too much money and they're very difficult to sell then, because none of the other top clubs want them. These players don't want to step down, and so United are stuck with them. So many examples of that. We touched on Martial earlier. I think Maguire is an example of that too. So many of them, that we've struggled to get rid of. So that seems like a really great idea. So what quotes from Radcliffe really stood out for you, Chris?
Oh, flip me, Kyle. That's a good question. Absolutely loads. Loads, like you said there. I can't even think of them all. The ones we already talked about are probably the big ones. I guess, say, for me, I'm just interested to hear the views on different things. I thought their views on the Glazers, were quite interesting. He was quite shrewd in that he was keen to he sort of recognised how difficult the Glazers' tenure has been, and how it felt to me almost like he was criticising their tenure, but without criticising them directly. Talking a lot about how the environment hasn't been right and how it's been poorly run and how football hasn't been prioritised, which obviously speaks to how the Glazers have run things. But then when asked about the Glazers directly, he said that they were really lovely guys. And despite what the media or people think, they're really, really personable and friendly, and he got really well with them. And then I think they asked the question about how their relationship would work. And he very straight up said, that this will only work if the relationship that we have continues to be good. And the process is so difficult to get through and stress. So that was no fault of the Glazers. That was the process. But in the difficulty of the process, we got to know each other really well. We formed a bond. So I just thought it was very clever how, he was very keen and very shrewd in not criticising them, and actually, almost telling people they're actually quite nice and you should give them a bye ball. But at the same time, very clearly saying the club's been run so poorly, it's a mess, and we're here to sort it out. So yeah, I just saw that thought that was quite an interesting point that we hadn't talked about. But in general, I just like his way of going, even when kind of pressed on difficult questions about his tax status, which would give him some criticism. You know, he very quickly stamped that out. Not saying that I maybe agree with that, yes or no, but I thought his approach to it was good from a PR perspective. So it showed me that he's a very guy who wants to make, comes across as having integrity and honesty, and at the same time not getting drawn into things that are going to make him look bad or negative. So yeah, I just thought generally he seemed like a shrewd operator, which should be no surprise given he's a billionaire. He's obviously got there for a reason. He obviously knows what he's doing and how to conduct himself. But yeah, I mean, my feelings were generally positive. I think at the end of it all, I think the other thing we haven't talked about, Kai, that I thought was interesting was the redevelopment of the stadium or building of a new stadium. I thought that was a really big talking point and something that he seemed extremely keen on, and he seemed to be very much pushing that agenda. You know, that he framed it in the context of building a Wembley for the North and saying that some of the, you know, almost saying some of the national games should happen there. Yeah, I think you and I talked about this, whether that might actually come to fruition. I think might not actually happen, but the stadium itself may happen. And I thought that could be a good thing. So interesting. Saying all the right things. You can tell he's trying to appeal to the local people in Greater Manchester, appealing to the wider fan base. Saying all the right things, you know, almost like he knows what the fans are thinking and trying to appease them. So interesting to see how it pans out, but seems positive on the face of it, I would say, for sure.
Yeah, I think plan A is to build a new stadium beside the current Old Trafford. But he's looking for government funding. Number one, it's difficult to see him getting that. With him being Britain's richest man and Man United being Britain's richest club, I don't see how you can justify getting taxpayers' money to build a stadium in those circumstances. Yeah. I haven't said that, you know, Man City Stadium, that was funded by a taxpayer, so was West Ham's stadium, so he can point to that. But even if he did get an alliance, it would probably only be, you know, a very small amount of money in comparison to what the stadium will actually cost. So I don't see the point in going down that road. He's still going to, even if he gets a government grant, he's still going to have to pay the majority of it himself, or the club is going to. So he also talked about plan B and plan C, and those obviously involve the redevelopment of the current Old Trafford, which obviously wouldn't be a bad idea. That's what Liverpool have done. Rather than building a new stadium, they've redeveloped, you know, one stand at a time, which is obviously an option for United. But ideally, we'd love to have our own version of the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium, you know, a very, very modern stadium. You know, Real Madrid have went down the renovation route. I think Barcelona are doing the same. So yeah, it'd be good to see us do that because Old Trafford is massively outdated now. Best stadium in England, as Radcliffe said, maybe 20 years ago, but not anymore, because Glazers have done absolutely no work to it, and it's long been highlighted the leaky roof, and obviously that gets highlighted more when you're not winning. The Glazers think doing a wee bit of a paint job around the outside of it, putting all this red lick of paint is suddenly gonna, you know, stem the flow of fans asking for, you know, an upgrade. But you know what they're like, they're cheapskates. But thankfully they're not in charge of the operation anymore. There's silent partners, really. So just looking down at more of the quotes from Radcliffe during the week, I mean, there's so many of them. You know, that's why I was saying that, you know, journalists were struggling with what headline to go with, because he was giving them so much material. He did say that Ineos had made mistakes at Nice, and that I wouldn't want to be where we have made quite a few mistakes in football, but I wouldn't want to be where I am today if I hadn't made those mistakes. So what he's saying is that United will benefit from the lessons that Ineos have taken from the ownership of Nice. This is not their first buy into a football club. They've owned two football clubs already, so whatever mistakes they've made, you know, they've learned from that. So hopefully they won't make the same mistakes at United, and that's what he's saying. He also has made it quite clear that he doesn't anticipate that Omar Berada will be implicated in Man City's 115 charges. He's confident about that. Also, he has, what else did he talk about? Yeah, that as well. There was, yeah, so much of it, wasn't there? Yeah, the public funding thing. Radcliffe tells me there clearly has to be a conversation with the government about the regeneration of the wider area. Yeah, possibly the government could get involved in, I think even the Mayor of Manchester is on board with that, you know, redeveloping the area around Old Trafford. You could see that happening. Apparently Gary Neville is going to be consulted on this as well. He's a local businessman, so
he I heard that, yeah, yeah. I sort of get the feeling, Kyle, you know, that what, I mean, again, you know, he's it's all words and he's saying the right things, but it almost sounds like he's talking about building, having some sort of legacy. I mean, the one thing that does give me, I mean, I as you know, I'm quite a sentimental fan, you know, and I kind of like tradition and all that kind of stuff, and, you know, continuing to play at Old Trafford sort of speaks to that for me. But at the same time, I feel like, you know, if you're in Jim Ratcliffe's shoes and you're thinking, you know, in 25 years time I might not be around anymore, you know, what do I want to be remembered for? You know, it's definitely a nice thought to think I can be remembered for being the man that, you know, put Manchester United back on the map with the greatest stadium in Europe. Again, you know, that's a nice legacy to leave, and something that will give, you know, a platform for, you know, for the club for, you know, a long time to come. So I can kind of see is, and I think, you know, the same with sort of helping to rejuvenate the area in general, you know, I think he might see that as a kind of a legacy that he would like to leave, or at least that's the sort of the noises that he's making anyway. So I think that kind of would be nice. Like I say, you know, me being a bit of a traditional fan, I always would have been slightly against the new stadium in the past, but I feel like it might be a good option. The other thing that I noticed that he'd said as well was actually to build it beside Old Trafford, but not to knock Old Trafford down. So actually keep it as well. So you'd have both, and the ladies team could play there, and maybe youth teams, I think, could play there, and it would be something that the community would use. So you'd still have Old Trafford, but just then have the first team play in this sort of, you know, state-of-the-art modern stadium beside it. So yeah, so, that sounds like a nice option potentially.
So Old Trafford and New Trafford.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. One thing I thought was interesting, just to mention it, I read somewhere yesterday or the day before that apparently that Martin Edwards, when he was chairman, bought a lot of ground beside Old Trafford fairly cheap in the 1990s, which is what has actually given the platform to have this new stadium built. And I guess the reason I'm bringing that up is it brings me back to what kind of good custodians of the club may look like, and the kind of things that you'd want to be thinking about. So if Radcliffe's in that mold, then hopefully, you know, he'll be thinking the future as well and doing some things that'll preserve, you know, good things for the club down the line, which is what the Glazers clearly haven't done, you know, short-term thinking all the time. So yeah, interesting.
Yeah, there's so much space around the stadium that's owned by the club. You know, I think there's two car parks alone, that they could build another two stadiums on that site and keep the Old Trafford. You know, that's how big it is. I want to come to what Danny is saying here. He's talking about Radcliffe here. His aura is what stood out to me. And the fact that we physically have a presence in terms of ownership to hold accountable going forward for the footballing operations. Yeah, you know, the Glazers have been absentee landlords, whereas Radcliffe has done more interviews in one day than the Glazers did in 20 years. So it feels weird, it feels strange, but it's fantastic to see an owner who's willing to talk to the media, and I think we're going to see a lot of this. If United are doing well or doing badly, we're going to see Radcliffe doing regular interviews and taking account for the decisions that have been taken at the club. He also mentioned Newcastle playing hardball over Dan Ashworth. He said they're silly numbers. Sir Jim Ratcliffe tells me he can understand Newcastle United being upset over the club's pursuit of Dan Ashworth, but dismisses paying $20 million to release him from gardening leave. He said that makes absolutely no sense. I think he called it absurd as well in a different interview. Another thing I liked was that he mentioned that he was at the New Camp in 1999 for the Champions League final with his 11-year-old son at the time. And even when he was doing those interviews, he had programs from all these famous Manchester United matches, including the 1999 Champions League final, just to show that he had a collection of all these programs. I think he even had
That's nice.
a Cantona shirt on display from the Munich Memorial match, which Cantona played in, you know, over 20 years ago.
Pretty nice. Yeah, you're right. He's definitely trying to show that he is a genuine fan, you know, because as I always joke around with you, Kyle, you know, this whole boyhood fan, you hear it from everybody all the time, loses meaning. So I guess he is trying to show he is a genuine fan. So yeah, hopefully that's good.
Yeah, and even when he talks, even his knowledge of the current team and previous teams, it shows that he's a fan. There's no way you could do all that research in just a few months or a few weeks. It seems genuine to me that he has been following it his whole life.
Okay.
So to summarize, in the short term, it's going to be brutal. I think, especially with these injuries, but in the long term, there's reasons to be cheerful. And we might see the beginning of the return of the old United from the summer onwards. So we shall leave it there. Please leave a like on the video, subscribe to the channel, and get more of your thoughts in. And it's been a pleasure as always, Chris.
Yep, you too, Kyle. Enjoy the chat as always, mate. Take care. Hopefully chat to you soon. Good man.
All right, I'll see you later. Okay.